All right. So again, welcome to the monthly meeting of the Alliance for Constitutional Sex Offense Laws. This meeting is being recorded, both audio and visual. So folks, if you don't want to be known, you don't want to be seen or heard, then you can certainly listen without speaking. It's certainly an option. But on the other hand, if you do have a question for Chance Oberstein or I, this is an opportunity for you to ask a question. Chance and I won't give anybody legal advice during this call, but we can give you some general information and then encourage you to call us for a private consultation at a later time. Okay, so my name is Janice Bellucci. I am a civil rights attorney. I'm also the founder and executive director of the Alliance. And so I'm very grateful to see your happy faces and your names on the screen here. Thank you for joining us. This is really an important meeting that we have. It's a way for us to share information with you. And guess what? It's meant to be a two-way method of communication. And so you will have opportunities to speak. You'll have opportunities to ask questions. And that's coming up soon. So joining me today is none other than criminal defense attorney Chance Oberstein. Chance.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Chance Oberstein. I practice criminal law. I'm the president of the board of the Alliance. It's good to see you today. And without further ado, let's get started.
Okay. We do have a lot to talk about. It's so interesting. Some of these issues just don't go away. And, you know, it makes sense for domestic and overseas travel. I mean, people are traveling, thank goodness, now that COVID is on the wane. It's not at least as big a danger as it used to be. And that's a good thing. So more people are traveling, including me. And so we certainly want to answer questions about that. We're also planning to talk about the SORNA regulations and the lawsuit that's pending here in California and federal district court. And boy, it's quite the tennis match, isn't it? Watching the ball fly across the court, only to be in never land. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a little bit. We have, of course, some information to share with you about the case we filed on behalf of registrants who are also on the, who are military retirees and how they're being denied access to military bases right now. And again, we have a case pending about that. We have an important update. And probably the most exciting thing that Chance and I have to talk about today, quite frankly, is to talk about the tiered registry law here in California. So we'll leave that conversation to the end because I know that there are people joining the call today who are not from California and maybe are not as interested in the tiered registry law as people who are inside the state. So again, we'll save that to the end, but there's a lot of movement on this topic. A lot of people getting, off the registry because of the tiered registry law, but in my personal opinion, not as many people as could get off the registry if they would only file their petition. And Scott, I see you here and I know you're a happy camper because you're no longer on the registry because of tiered registry law. And I congratulate you for that. Scott and I work together on that. And, and one of the things that Chance and I are going to share with you all is what counties basically are doing things, the quickest, because there's all kinds of experiences out there. One county takes 2 months. In 2 months' time, they can, you know, because they have such an efficient system set up already, you in Alameda County, I'll just blurt it out, in Alameda County, you can get your petition filed and you can have your court order in hand in about 2 months' time. Right behind them is Ventura County, which is quite a surprise to me. And they take about 3 months. But then there's other courts that, you know, can take up to 9 months. So it's not a one answer fits all circumstances. And Chance and I will explain in some respect, you know, why that is. So let's go ahead and wait. A couple of things, too. I want to talk about scam alert. Here's scam alert. We had a board member who last week got a scam call. And even though he's a board member and even though he's got a PhD, you know, he's well educated, he still had an emotional reaction when he got the call from the scammer, right? So it's like, oh my gosh, and they're telling him, you need to come in, you need to give a DNA sample. The DNA sample we had for you, you know, got corrupted somehow. And so you need to come in now. And if you don't come in now, I have a warrant for your arrest and you're going to be taken into custody immediately. Well, that gets most people's attention, right? And it got his attention as well. So folks, the scammers are at it constantly. And you know, some of these folks must have been like drama majors in high school or college or both, because they seem to do a pretty convincing job of frightening people. And then, of course, the ask comes, which is, oh, you don't want to go to custody? You don't want us to send a squad car to pick you up? Then here, you can pay us money. And folks, if anybody ever asks you for money like that, just hang up. That's the easiest way to get rid of a scam call, is just hang up on them. You don't have to berate them. You don't have to do anything else. Somebody said they bought a whistle and they blow the whistle in their ear. Okay. You know, but you don't even have to do that. Just hang up, right? Just hang up. That's all you have to do and disconnect. And there was one gentleman recently who contacted me, and he, you know, he believed what the scammers told him, and he went to the bank to go make this large withdrawal, thousands of dollars. And fortunately, the teller at the bank noticed that he wasn't acting the way most people act. I don't even know how to describe it, but he seemed to be under a lot of stress. And so as he was going to request this withdrawal, the teller basically contacted somehow or made some signal to a police officer who was already in the bank. Okay, already in the bank. And this police officer came over and talked to the man, and he was able to help the registrant basically understand that he was being scammed. And so the man did not take the money out of his account. He did not pay the scammer thousands of dollars. But Chance and I, we know of somebody who did pay $10,000 to a scammer. So unfortunately, it does happen sometimes. So again, please be on alert. If somebody calls you up and says, they're Sheriff so-and-so or Detective blah, 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 you know, listen very critically. And then, you know, the first time they say, oh, well, your DNA sample isn't correct or anything along those lines, Chance, I just... that seems to me the latest message that they're trying to give to the registrant that has to do with a DNA sample, you know, where there's a warrant out for your arrest. But can you think of any other things, messages that you've heard about?
No, the common thread is that something's going to happen to you unless you hesitate to act immediately. Common thread, keep you on the phone. Common thread, go to a kiosk, even if it's near the department. Common thread, they're very professional. They sound like a real organization, a real law enforcement agency. But, you know, law enforcement agencies, one, don't make demands like that. They don't make demands like that. They don't ask for money. They don't keep you on the phone. If they want to bag you, they just come to your door and bag you. And if you don't answer the door and they have a warrant, they come in. It's as simple as that. So, you know, you'd be done already. The fact of the matter is if you get somebody like that on the phone, the easiest thing to do is just hang up on them. One, two, refer them to your attorney, or three, hang up on them and call the police, you know, because you've got a real problem when it comes to these types of people. They're just like vultures and they're bloodsuckers, and you can tell who they are right away because they'll just try to keep you on. So common threads, just think of common threads. One, you don't worry about what they tell you because the story is always going to change. That one, they're going to want to keep you on the phone. Two, they're going to demand money. And three, you're going to have to go make that deposit at the kiosk or something because you surely aren't going into a police department to make that kind of payment. That doesn't happen. So just think about that. And if you're unsure, call one of us and we'll be happy to remind you that that's exactly what's going on. Get involved. So you'll be okay.
Thank you, Chance. Does anybody have a question or a comment today about the scams? Has anybody been gotten a scam call that they want to share about? It's okay if you don't. All right, let's move on. The other one has to do with compliance checks. So I got a very anxious phone call this week from a board member who said that four police officers, armed police officers, showed up at his door and showed up at his door. And he's not on parole. He's not on probation. And guess what? He didn't answer the door. So after they left, he did open the door, the front door, and saw that there was a business card there, right? And so, and the business card says, please call Sergeant blah, blah, blah. This is a real person, by the way. He saw, because he has a Ring doorbell, he saw four people approach his front door in police uniforms, and they, you know, were respectful, I guess, but, you know, still, if your neighbors see four our police officer showing up at your front door, they might raise an eyebrow. And again, he chose not to answer the front door because he's not on parole or probation. And it's his right not to. So if you're not on parole and you're not on probation and they don't have a search warrant, you don't have to answer the front door if the police show up. But what happened afterwards is that he got very anxious when he talked to the police officer, the one that left the card behind, and he was very concerned that they were going to violate him, that they were going to bring him into the police station, et cetera. And so I was able to call the officer and basically calm everybody down on both sides, quite frankly. And so, you know, just explain. And he was, in fact, the one that was the victim of the scam call a week before that. So he was hyper alert and hypersensitive, right, when these four armed officers came up. And he's like, oh, my gosh, maybe that wasn't a scam after all last week, right? But it turns out it just was a coincidence. So anyway, I was able to talk to the police officer. And basically what she wanted was a copy of his lease. That was it. He lives in an apartment. She wanted a copy of his lease. And I was able to get her email address, and he sent the lease to her by email and a proof, you know, receipt that he had paid that month's rent. And then it was over. Okay. So the compliance checks, they're annoying. Chance, I don't know of any state law that actually authorizes them, but they sure seem to be happening.
Well, they can, of course, check to make sure that, you know, you provided them the right information. California interprets it that way. And, you know, the thing is, it's a great, avenue for overtime pay. And so what you do is you get, you know, the easiest thing to do is get a bunch of folks who, you know, want to get gravy and put them all together, put them in black suits and have them go knock on your door. That's what this is really all about. They could just as easily make a phone call or ask you to provide those at the station at your convenience, but, you know, it pays the bills. And so this is what I call the gravy train. Because that's exactly what they're doing.
Oh, I agree with you completely, Chance. I've been even told that there are like federal grants out there that are available to the local police officers. And so, you know, they get to dress up. Ooh, they look like they're really spiffy in those SWAT uniforms or whatever uniforms they wear. They got the guns on their hips and stuff. They look like tough guys and women. And the question is, what, you know, what is this about? Yeah. Like for him, our board member, he's lived in the same apartment for 8 years. Right? His address has not changed on the Megan's Law website. He's got the same address for 8 years, but they still like to come and visit him. So maybe, I don't know. I'm going to be silly, you know, but we'll just leave it at that. So folks, if somebody shows up at your front door, they're police officers, if you're not on parole, if you're not on probation, if you're not on supervised release, and they don't have a search warrant, you don't have to let them in your house, right? And I know that I recommend strongly that you do not let them inside of your house, because if they are inside of your house and they see something that they consider suspicious, the next thing you know, your house is going to be searched. You want to add to that, Chance?
Just that, you know, what you want to do is set aside your status for a minute and just remember that you're like everyone else, citizen of this country, have rights, and act like that. When people come to your door, make your choices appropriately. And I think you'll be fine. And I know it's an embarrassment. I know that, you know, people, especially if they live around clusters of people, they wonder why everybody's at your door. And I think that's usually the message that they're trying to put out, is that there's something going on that's wrong there. And, you know, they do that purposely. The way to diffuse it is just you be very even-tempered and to make choices as any other citizen of the state would make and go on with your life. And so, you know, and if you're not on probation or parole and you have no other obligation, it's monitoring. That's all it is. You're not obligated to open the door or interact with them or let them in or anything like that. So just keep that in mind.
And folks, if you choose to open the door, I strongly recommend that you go outside your apartment or home, wherever it is that you live, and talk to them outside your home. Because again, you don't want them inside, because if they see something that they think is quote suspicious, the next thing you know, they're going to be searching your house with probable cause, quite frankly. So you don't want to let them in the house. And the other thing is, okay, so let's just say you decide to go outside the door, outside your house, you close the door behind you so they can't see in, right? And then what do you say to them? And what can they ask about? They cannot ask you about your offense, okay? The purpose of a compliance check is to see if you actually live where you said you live. That's it, okay? So they don't get to ask about your sexual history. They don't get to ask about, you know, your recipe for cinnamon buns or anything else. The fact is they're only there to confirm that you reside there, and that's it. Okay, so before we go on, does anybody have a question or a comment about compliance checks? Hopefully you're not the subject to them. You know, one of our other people on our board, Frank Lindsay, he's lived in the same house for like 15 years and he lives in a single family home. What do you know? They keep coming to his house as well, right? They used to come quarterly and now they're only coming once a year. So maybe there's less grant money for these compliance checks than there used to be. I don't know.
Janice.
Okay. Yes, Kelly.
Briefly tell about the SWAT team showing up on my front porch.
Absolutely.
You know about it already. And it said SWAT on all over their costume. They had long guns and the whole works. It was really rather humorous after the whole thing was over, because the only reason they indicated for being there was the DOJ got a grant. And they were looking for a gun that John supposedly possessed. And they didn't understand. It wasn't properly accounted for or something, and paperwork. And they had a piece of paper in their hand, but we never got to see that piece of paper. And by the way, John never owned a gun like that, ever. And as they were standing at our door, they complimented us on our view and our yard. And one of them wanted to buy my classic pickup truck that's parked alongside the house. And turned out, another one of the four had worked with my son-in-law and called my son-in-law and actually told my son-in-law it was BS, except he said the word, because they got this grant, they put on their SWAT outfits and, you know, walked around and acted like big, hard guys, except with us, they were very friendly. What annoys me is my neighbors saw the SWAT team walking all around our house. And by the way, we've lived here 36 years.
So it just goes to show, it doesn't make a difference how long that you've lived there, right?
No, not a bit. Not a bit.
Right. So Kathleen, I'm glad that you spoke up on that topic. And folks, last month we started something new in our monthly meetings, and it was called Meet a Board Member. Now, Chance and I are board members, and you certainly have heard from us a lot, but we wanted to bring to your attention other members of the board so that they could share their experiences with you as well. And one of them is indeed Kathleen Garner, who just spoke. So, Kathleen, why don't you just go ahead and continue your story?
Oh, okay.
And by the way, if you have a question or comment while she's speaking or later on, you can certainly do that, okay?
Yeah, happy to field questions. Again, my name is Kathleen. As Janice just said, I'm the wife of a registrant, the mom of two adult grown daughters, grandmother of five. And I live in very Southern California, San Diego, to be exact. I am a fourth generation native Californian and have lived from one end of it to the other. I have been active in AXOL, formerly our California RSOL, pardon me, over a decade. I've been, as I am now, a board member, secretary of that board, and president of that board. My husband was in the Navy 28 years in law enforcement. He went to college for law enforcement. He was picked in the Navy for the first draft for mastered arms when it became a regular rate, which could be called Navy police, if you like. When he retired from the Navy, he was hired by the San Diego Sheriff's Department. And after 16 and a half years and a fight in the jail, he was medically retired due to back injury. He didn't want to retire. Besides that, you know, he was getting older, as we all do, unfortunately. And his retirement, his unwanted retirement, threw him into a depression, and he refused counsel, unfortunately. And at that same time, I had a serious health issue. I had an emergency appendectomy at Balboa Naval Hospital, where they let me sit in the emergency room all night while my appendix burst and became necrotic. And they finally did take it out. And a couple of months later, I started having problems. And from the infection that spread, I had an abscess in my liver, and they told me I had metastatic liver cancer. And all of this happened in a very short time. And I believe it had a lot to do with what happened to us. Oh, I also ended up having my gallbladder out because of the infection from my burst appendix. During this time, the legal industrial complex entered my life. And I say that with sarcasm and dislike. I guess most of you probably know why. For me, it was an invading horde in riot gear with guns drawn and in front of them ready, marching up my front lawn. The person in charge told me that they knew my husband wasn't there and that I was alone because they watched him drive away. And it just went downhill from there. Sorry, my husband just destroyed my telephone setup here. Sorry, there. Let's see if I can make this go away. There, I think I'm back on. Am I, Janice? Hello?
Yes, Kathleen, you're on.
Thank you. Okay. Then a year later, my husband was convicted in court of a non-contact CP offense, and he was incarcerated for 5.5 years. During the hellish time between the cops showing up and him going away, the media had a lot of fun with us. When I refused to talk to the newswoman who came to my house while my husband was in jail, they went door to door up and down my street, told all my neighbors that my husband was a sex offender, et cetera, and he hadn't even been convicted yet. They filmed those interviews and televised them. My husband's in his San Diego Sheriff's Department sergeant's uniform, and those videos was shown on all the major newscasts for about 10 days with miscellaneous pictures of our house and me. And by the way, my husband had not had his uniform on for 3 years, but they made sure he was shown on TV in that uniform. After my husband went away and was incarcerated, the probation department turned their attention on me, demanding to come in and talk to me with no previous notice and using strong arm tactics, in my opinion, to push their agenda. After I told the first one I resented his threatening manner, he asked me for an appointment and brought his supervisor along. Surprise for him, this older woman supervisor and I got along famously. When she left, she took my hand in both of hers when I preferred it for a handshake and squeezed it and told me how much she had enjoyed meeting me. And that gentleman disappeared and was no longer heard from. And when my husband came home, he had an all-new probation officer who told him and me that he would treat me with all possible respect. And he did for 2 years. Unfortunately, then he got another one. And they rotated. And this one is a problem child. I think he's new to this field of endeavor. And when he doesn't, I don't know how to say this. I guess he doesn't stir up enough excitement when he's here talking to my husband. So now he's turned to me. He really firmly believes that my husband is using my computers illicitly, despite the fact that I have shown him my computer, shown him their password protected, etc. Well, now my computers aren't even in the house. They're at my son-in-law's house. Hence me using my iPhone to do this little talk. We don't know why we can't get rid of this guy for 2.5 years, because most of the people that I know around here get a new probation officer about twice a year. This guy has lied about us in court. The judge jumped all over him, and he complained about me asking permission for my husband to drive me to Los Angeles and attend a meeting of Axol. And she also jumped all over him about that. I'd like you all to know that attending those meetings, according to this federal judge, is part of your First Amendment rights. And she saw no reason why my husband could not travel to Los Angeles to attend one. One win, two wins, maybe. Anyway, the hardest to deal with for me, and this is really emotional for me, my two daughters both happen to be married to law enforcement, and they pulled away from us, and mostly me, because my husband was away. I was allowed to be with my grandchildren, thank God. And this estrangement has improved, but the relationships really, I don't think, are as before. My neighbors, only about two families still talk to me and my husband out of a whole big street where I've lived 36 years. Nobody has been mean or threatening. We've had no malicious mischief, but it's very hurtful. People I went to church with for years no longer contact me. That's probably really been the hardest thing to deal with. Not even the POs get on my nerves that much. Janice, am I running out of time? I see you there.
Yes. Yeah. It's about time to wrap up.
Okay. Well, I just want to say, I'm looking forward to my husband getting off probation. And I want to tell everybody that even with all these hardships, Axol, formerly California RSOL, has really been my saving grace. And I advise everyone to attend conferences if you possibly can, like the phone one that's coming up for us. You'll learn a lot. You'll find out you're not the only person in the world, and it does help with that feeling of alienation.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you for sharing your experiences with folks. And folks, I know that there are a lot of people online right now who are registrants themselves, and maybe not so many family members, but I think it's really important for you to hear from Kathleen, who is a family member. And, you know, I first met her husband, John, before John was convicted, and was fortunate enough to meet Kathleen, I also think, before John was convicted, or at least before he went into custody. And so she and I become personal friends. And I have learned so much from her about the experience of family members and you know, developed a lot of understanding and compassion for family members, because it really is like family members are also on the registry. So thank you, Kathleen, for that. And I know, too, when Kathleen was talking, she mentioned briefly our annual conference. So Axol does have an annual conference. It's coming up in just a few weeks on October 1st. And I really hope that you all will be able to join us. Like this meeting, it will be recorded. So just in case you can't devote your entire Saturday, October 1st, to the conference, the fact is you can certainly listen to the recording later. And in addition to Chance and I, we'll both be speaking, but we have people from outstate, like Aaron Marcus, who was the lead attorney in the great Pennsylvania decision that was issued last month, and he's from Pennsylvania. And then we have Adele Nicholas, who is in Illinois. She's in Chicago, and she's one of our former board members, and she's going to speak too about a case that she won up at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. So we've got, you know, other board members, Catherine Carpenter. She's going to talk about her latest law review article, which is called the Irrebuttable Presumption Doctrine, which maybe that sounds a little too esoteric, but the fact is Aaron Marcus put that doctrine into practice in his lawsuit, and he won. So it's a really an important doctrine. And so we have other people talking about other topics and such, including people, you know, who have succeeded despite the background on the registry. Chance, is there anybody else that you're any other highlight you'd like to make about the conference?
No, I think that you'll enjoy the lineup and the speakers. And I think that you'll learn a lot. Every year it's different. And every year there's something new to talk about. And every year people come away saying, yep, I enjoyed that. I did learn a lot. It was worthwhile. So join us.
Thank you, Chance. And folks, we are planning to have an in-person conference next year. It's really hard when you have to plan conferences like 6 months ahead of time to decide whether or not to have something in person or to have something virtual like this. And we understand that there's a real benefit when we have a virtual gathering like today, right? In that people from all over the country can join us quite easily. So when we have our conference next year, we're going to try to make it a hybrid conference. I think that's the latest term. So in other words, we'll have a conference in person, but we'll also have, people will be able to virtually attend in case you can't be there in person. Okay. So, conference sign up, please. All you have to do is go to the website, the allforconsolaws.org. We've got in the upper right hand corner a box that talks about the conference. You can just click on that. The cost is $25 for an entire day of a conference. I don't know anybody else that does it more efficiently and cost less. So we hope that you'll join us. And whether or not you are able to view the conference in real time, you will get access to the recordings if, in fact, you have signed up for the conference. And folks, I'm very careful in my language when I talk about the conference. We don't register anybody. Okay. I understand the R word. No, it's not in our vocabulary. We sign people up for the conference and we use that word deliberately. By the way, there's also scholarships available for anybody. If you don't have, you can't afford to pay the $25. We have right now, I think over $600 in scholarship money. So we've got a lot of scholarships available. Okay, so without further ado, let's talk about one of the substantive issues that I would imagine a lot of people are wondering about, and that is this lawsuit, a pending lawsuit about the SORNA regulations. So what's going on? And I'll tell you what, I've practiced law for 39 years, and this is the craziest situation I've ever seen. When a judge changes the date of the hearing 6 times, what in the heck is going on, right? So the hearing, I think, originally was supposed to be back in June. And here it is, the latest date was September 26th. And then the Pacific Legal Foundation that actually filed the lawsuit, they have asked the judge to basically make a decision without a hearing. So the judge could have done that himself if he had wanted to. We're not sure why he chose not to do that, but instead leave it to the parties to make that decision. I don't know if the federal government has agreed to that waiver of an oral argument. I think that is quite possible, right? That in fact that will happen. So because I don't think they have anything to gain by having a hearing. The both sides have, you know, submitted a lot of briefs and a lot of supporting documents. And so I think the case is really well laid out in those documents. And I think the judge can, in fact, make a decision if only he will. So I will tell you my concern about this is that the judge will sit on this decision for a long time. Do you have any concerns about that, Chance?
Yeah, of course I do. The problem with this phase of the litigation is that, you know, the issue is asking the judge to freeze it in time until the issues are decided. That's what a preliminary injunction is. Just don't apply it. Don't apply these regulations until, these things are litigated and a resolution is found. Unless the judge does that, then everybody has to act, in accordance with the rules and regulations. And the reason there's litigation there to begin with is because from the perspective of the litigants here, it's a violation of separation of powers. And from our standpoint, it's unconstitutional because it overreaches. So we've got two huge issues. Oral argument fills gaps that the judge is unclear about and sometimes is very persuasive because the gaps are where the judge usually gets prompted to go left or right. And so it is worrisome. It bothers me in a way because this is such important litigation. There should be oral arguments. And waiving that tells me that someone's thinking about passing the ball, and I don't like that. I don't like the hot potato theory of litigation, and that seems to be where this is going. I hope not, but that's my sense of it.
Chance, I'm going to have to remember that phrase, the hot potato litigation. I like that. but I agree. I mean, that's what it seems like here. It's like, oh my goodness, I don't want to make this decision. One of the things I've thought about, I don't have anything to back this theory up, is that the judge didn't want to have a whole courtroom full of full of registrants, right? Or registrants and family members. I think the judge might have been afraid of that, or maybe afraid that there was going to be some big protest that, you know, somebody's going to come and throw potatoes or eggs or anything else at tomatoes, at the registrants and family members. I really don't know why, the judge did this, but half of the, remember, it got delayed 6 times. Half of the delays were because the assistant U.S. attorney, government, asked for the delay, and half of the time was the judge acting on his own initiative. So it's a real head scratcher. I've never had that happen before in one of my cases, and we'll see. I because I'm an optimist, I'm hoping that what it's about is that the judge is going to rule in our favor, and he just didn't want to make big to-do of it, right? We'll see. But I'm serious in saying we may be waiting a year or longer for the judge's decision. So it could take a while. There's nothing to nudge them forward. Also, the Pacific Legal Foundation, they're very dedicated to this lawsuit. And, you know, they're ready to take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court if need be. But gee whiz, we need a decision from the judge, right, on this. So we'll see what happens. But folks, if you have a question about the SORNA regulations, or you have a question about this litigation, this is the time to ask Chance and I, because otherwise we're going to move on to the next topic. So if you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand, and you can do it one of two ways. You can use the, what, reactions? Yes. Down at the bottom of your screen, there's a button that says reactions, and then that you can raise your hand that way. If you want to just wave at us, if your video is on, you can wave at us, and the Chancellor and I will know that you have a comment or a question. Let's just give folks a minute here. Okay, don't see anything. In the meantime, you know, there's this cloud that's hanging over every registrant's head, and not knowing whether or not the SORNA regulations apply to you. So I think my basic understanding is if the government doesn't notify you that the regulations apply to you, then you don't have to comply with them. But if you were convicted in federal court, they apply to you like automatically. If you're in a SORNA compliant state, they basically apply to you automatically. California, thank goodness, is not a SORNA compliant state, and therefore they don't apply automatically. And I think, but it's not tested, folks, in the courts or anywhere else, that the government will have to notify you that all of a sudden you have to comply with at least portions of the SORNA regulations. Do you want to add anything to that, Chance, before we go on? An attorney. Good idea. Yeah,
see an attorney.
Yeah. And you know, as officers of the court, Chance and I would like to give you really clear answers. Unfortunately, there are no clear answers. So again, we hope that you'll understand that this is our position and it's not tested yet. Okay, so let's move on. I think this will be quick, and then we can go on some meatier topics. It has to be having to do with military retirees who are on the registry and who have been denied access to military bases. We did file a lawsuit way back in, what month was that? May 12th. So that was a long time ago, and it's moving very slowly through the courts. Interesting thing that happened just a few weeks ago is that we got a new judge. So the judge to whom the case had been assigned, who, by the way, was a military veteran, something happened behind the scenes, and all of a sudden the case was transferred, and now the presiding judge of the Central District of California in Los Angeles, this is federal district court, is now the judge assigned to the case. Presiding judges don't take many cases, folks. They're really in charge of the administration of the court. But when they do, I think it's a signal that this is an important case. So we have the presiding judge now in this case, and we have a hearing in the case on November 18th. So we have documents that have to be filed certainly before then. The position of the government so far is like, oh, you don't have a right to all these things that we promised you a long time ago. Yeah, recruiters might have told you that, you know, we're going to take care of your medical needs for life. You can go to the commissary in exchange for life. Oh, but guess what? We've changed our mind now. You can't. Because that's what's happened. Then this is after the military had gotten benefits sometimes of people like Kathleen's husband, who I believe spent 28 years on active duty, and then he retired. Well, now he cannot go on to, and he's been denied access to a military base. So So he's one of many people. The gentleman who's a plaintiff in this lawsuit, an Air Force officer, he, you know, has gotten his medical care for over 50 years. He's now in his mid-70s, and he's gotten his medical care for over 50 years from the military. And for the first time in his life, he was told, nope, we're not going to let you on base. You can't get your medical care. And the timing for him is particularly bad because he was just diagnosed with diabetes for the first time in his life. So he hasn't gotten any medical care for that condition because he hasn't been allowed on base. Chance, anything you want to join or add to that?
No. I think you're covering just fine.
Okay. All right. Now we'll go on to a topic that Chance is an expert about, and that has to do with travel. Okay. So, Chance, why don't you lead the discussion about the overseas travel, and then I'll join you when it comes to domestic travel.
All right. What you need to know about overseas travel really is just a few things. One of which is that there is overseas travel for at least registrants is regulated federally by the IML, International Megan's Law, and if one, you're registering, and two, the alleged victim in your case is 16 or under, is a minor, actually 17, by federal standards, that's how a minor is identified federally, then the government can put a special marking on your passport, which designates you as a registered sex offender and causes you issues wherever you travel. If you don't fall into those parameters, but you register, you don't have to worry about it. In other words, if the victim of the offense is an adult, you don't fall under the parameters of IML, and or if you're no longer registering, you don't fall under the parameters. What you should know if you fall under those parameters and you're in California is that if you're going to travel, you need to comply at least by giving 21 days notice of your travel. And I would refer you to the DOJ website in California. It's California Department of Justice website. And you can look at what they have written about it and what they may provide for you. I think they provide a form for you to fill out. It's a 21-day form. And, you know, be 21 days or more before you travel, you need to submit that form. And, you know, we're not a SORNA compliant state. There are states that are SORNA compliant. We are not. The federal law is not about necessarily SORNA. It may apply universally to all states. We have not had a test case yet. You don't want to be the first. So it's important to comply with that just to make sure that you're not going to set precedent here in California for violating the IML. The second thing to understand is that when you travel internationally and you fall under these parameters, you get notice, and these notices go out to countries you're traveling to, which can cause you a lot of discomfort and or problems with entering countries or deportation. There are certain countries that will disallow your entry if you're registering, and also may not let you in even if you're not registering if you have a felony, which is fairly recent. Every country differs, and it's good before you travel to a country to understand what their rules and regulations are. And often you do that by contacting their embassies here in the United States and or overseas to find out exactly, you know, what requirements they have for entry and matching them to, you know, exactly what your situation is. And on that subject, and something maybe a little new to all of you potential international travelers, is to know exactly what your situation is. I speak to a lot of people who want to travel, and the first thing they say to me is, when I ask them what the conviction is for, they say it's for 290. 290 is not a conviction. 290 is a set of rules and regulations pertaining to convictions. Okay. What the crime is important to know. Whether it's a felony or misdemeanor is important to know. What the ages of the alleged victims in each case, or case is important to know. All these things are. Before you get ready to travel, you should have these all down. You should know what your situation is so that you can look ahead. But in any event, if you are registering and you're going to travel, I would suggest as insurance to fill out the 21-day form. Also, you know, again, with respect to countries that you may be wanting to travel to around the globe, there is a list of countries. They're called Schengen countries. And they just don't go along with the program. You know, they're not gonna exclude you. They're not gonna exclude you for registration and or felonies. Again, I would check with each one, but you know, in general, you're free to travel places like Italy, places like Spain, and a whole group of others. You can just look them up on the internet. You would be free to enter those zones and travel from place to place, notwithstanding one, your personal situation, or two, the 21-day notice you give. But remember that any form of travel, whether it's domestic or international, is regulated. Domestic regulated by state and federal, and of course international, federal. And so you should be aware of these things, and you should take them under consideration when you plan to travel. And if you're confused about it, and say you say, you know, I don't know what this all means, speak to an attorney beforehand and tell them, you know, exactly what your situation is and where you plan to go and what you plan to do. And, you know, it's easy to give a little bit of guidance. It doesn't take too long to get guidance in order to get you on the right track so that you can go out and enjoy yourself and travel. And there's plenty of places to travel to, and I wouldn't discourage anybody from doing that. So anyways, that's my nutshell talk about international travel. I'm sure Janice has more to say about that.
I have a couple things. Oh, and we have a question. Get to you in just a minute, Ed. Chance mentioned that there are Schengen nations, and folks, those are 26 countries in Europe that allow registrants to travel. The four large ones are Italy, Germany, Spain, and France. So you can get some really good food in those four countries. I'm kind of a foodie myself. And there's things to see as well. So, but there's 22 smaller countries. And the list of those 26 European nations is on the Axel website. So if you go to our website and toward the top, it says something about international travel. If you click on the link there, one of the things you'll see is the list of the 26 countries. And then the other thing is there's another organization out there. Well, there's a person out there. He's really not an organization, is he? Who is collecting information about registrants' experiences trying to travel to different countries around the globe. And he's got a matrix. And on the matrix, he lists countries where registrants have been turned away. And so, you know, I'll just put it out there. If you look at his matrix, you'll see that the continent of Asia is really off limits with only one exception, and that exception is Hong Kong. So be very, very careful, because if you go to those other countries, you're going to waste a lot of time and you're going to waste a lot of money going there, because you will not be allowed to exit the airport when you get there. Okay, Ed, you got your hand up. I'm asking you to unmute yourself, if you would, if you have a question or a comment about international travel.
Yeah, so I just traveled. I left the United States yesterday, and I wanted to thank Chance personally, because he was the one who instructed me on how to do everything. So I don't think SORNA applies to me specifically, but like he said before, he didn't want me to be the test case. So just to kind of go over everything, I went, when I did my annual this year, I asked for a notification letter, and they gave me one. And they asked you a bunch of questions. There was a couple questions that actually bothered me, because they asked you specifically where, like an address of where you're going to go. And I actually discussed this with Chance. I actually vented to him, and he said that it's best to put down an address, because they want a specific address. And I thought it was kind of like them overreaching. Like, what do you want an address that's outside the country? After I did the 21 days, I turned that in. I had to go back this week to call it a checkout. So basically they do everything that we normally do for an annual checkup or annual, registration, but they just put down again, they ask you for the address of the country, when you're going, if you're coming back, and it's the exact same thing, the exact same paperwork. The only thing is, they put down out of state, and they said they don't have a box for out of the country. I didn't have any issues at the airport. I did everything timely. Most of my issues are in my own head. Every time I saw law enforcement, I think, oh my God, here they're going to get me. I had nothing to do with minors. My passport is clean. I have dual citizenship. So that might have affected it, but it's really important that everyone does everything exactly like it's supposed to be. Because I think, in my opinion, that they want us to misstep or miss something so that they can get us. I'm not on probation, I'm not on parole, but I do think if they had the chance to get me in their grasp again, they would. And again, thank you, Chance. I wish I would have found you as a lawyer, but when I went through all this initially, I don't think I would have had the same result. And if anybody out there is looking for a criminal attorney, go with Chance. All these sex offender laws are murky waters, and they're getting murkier, in my opinion. So my best analogy is, like, most lawyers are like a family practice doctor. You're not going to take a cancer patient to a family practice doctor. You're going to take it to a specialist. So go with Chance. He's a specialist, or go with Janice. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks so much, Ed. I appreciate that. And good luck. Good luck where you're at.
And I'd like to clarify, I am not a criminal defense attorney. So if you have a criminal defense need, please call Chance and not me. I'm a civil rights attorney. Okay, Robert, I think you got your hand up. Do you have a question or a comment, Robert? You're going to have to unmute yourself, sir. There you go.
Oops. I emailed with you last week, and I really appreciate it. I want to find out, how long can someone leave California before they – like, how long can someone travel is part one of the question. And then two, I was told by you that I could leave and live overseas and wine run down the sauna clock. But I was also told by the people in Germany that the state clock will not run when you're out of the country. My idea was to leave and come back in 10 years. But how long can someone travel and stay on the registry in California and run the clock? Does that make sense? If I'm gone for 6 months, or if I'm just back before my birthday?
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, Robert. I don't remember our prior conversation, but based upon what you just said, the fact is, if anybody leaves the state of California permanently, whether you're moving to another state or you're moving to another country, you're automatically taken off the California registry. It's just automatic. But if you're just going for 6 months, they will keep you on the registry. But I don't have a specific answer as far as if you were to leave the country for 10 years. I don't think that would count. I'd hate to have your lawyer making that argument because, you know, they're looking at 10 years of registration. Well, right. If you've been out of the country for 10 years, you're not registering for 10 years, that 10-year period.
If the SORNA expires and I move back in 10 years to a different state, I won't have an obligation to register under SORNA. I just got probation. I'm trying to navigate how to live a easy life, a good life, you know?
I'm not sure there's an expiration of SORNA. This is something I think that you're mixing up here. There's a required amount of years under SORNA and also under any state you reside. Sometimes they're in conflict, but in order to run out the clock, you've got to register for that time. You're not registered for that time. It just tolls the time that you have to register. And that's why whoever told you what they told you about, you know, not running out of the state clock was quite correct. You can travel, but if you're domiciled in a state and you actually live there and you're basically visiting wherever you're visiting, you're traveling. I'm not saying that can be indefinite, but, you know, if you're domiciled somewhere and you're registering there annually and, you know, you're back and forth, that's where you live. And so, you know, there's where you live and there's where you visit, or there's where you decided to live and you kind of said goodbye to the old way. You have to decide what you want to do. If you're leaving the states and you deregister out, and you go live someplace else, like in Europe, that's where you live. And if you're just going to visit for a while, you still live in the United States, even though you're visiting Europe. So try to separate those things. And if the issues become murky, you know, make a call and speak to an attorney and see if you can't iron them out before you make a major mistake.
How long can someone be on? You have to be here more than 6 months to reside in California. Like,
I didn't catch the last part of it because the transmission was bad. Can you repeat that again?
Just how long can someone, obviously someone can't just come back to California just on their birthday and register here because.
Robert, you're unfortunately, we can't hear what you're saying. I'm going to go ahead and mute you. Maybe if you could write something in the chat room. But I think Chance is recommending that you speak for an attorney anyway. All right, Bloss, you have your hand up. Oops. I'm sorry. I think I unmuted you. I muted you. Can you unmute yourself again, Bloss? There you go. You have a question or a comment this morning?
I have a question. The gentleman previously mentioned about dual citizenship. If you have a dual citizenship, are you required to report that to when you register yearly or not?
California does not require that you notify them of that. The new SORNA regulations do require that. But until you get notification from the California state government that you have to provide them with that information, I wouldn't do it. In fact, Blas, I think right now if you went into your registration office and said, hey, I just want you to know that I have a passport from Switzerland, they go, that's nice, right? I mean, I don't think they have I don't even think that they have a way to capture that information. So I think you have no obligation at this point in time to notify them.
How about if you are going to travel outside of the United States? Because if you are going to travel outside of the United States or going to foreign countries, I think the federal government is requiring that.
I'm clear of your question.
I mean to say, John, is if you are traveling in a foreign country outside of the United States, I think the federal government is requiring that you have to provide that information of your dual citizenship.
I can't comment on that. I don't know, boss. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Do you have an answer to that question, Chance?
Yeah, I heard the question. I'm unaware of that requirement. You know, because you think it is doesn't necessarily mean it is, but you know, it does, it does bear examination. My understanding is, that, you know, whatever the state requires when you travel internationally, it's pretty much laid out what you need to do depending on where you're jumping off from. You know, are you jumping off from California? Are you leaving from some other state? If you're leaving from some other state that has SORNA requirements, then you have to adhere to those requirements. If you're jumping off from California, you adhere to California rules and regulations. The only requirement I'm aware of at this point is the 21-day notice. You know, and that's not really required in California. We're doing that, recommending that at least, to cover you for, you know, IML purposes, but there's been no cases on it. And frankly, it's a gray area. But I will say that you have to put all this in perspective. And that is that this, whether it's on the federal level or the state level, this is about monitoring. And it's not about infringing on your right to travel in terms of you being a dual citizen or, you know, leaving the United States and, you know, traveling as a citizen of your other origin. I don't see it bleeding into that, you know, and I don't see any information, at least in California at this point, being shared on that level. So it's something I would definitely look into to double check, because you should always be diligent. But I'm unaware of anything at that level at this point.
One more question, last one. In a country that you are have a dual citizenship and the federal government or the country that you are have a dual citizenship, although you cannot go there, like for example in Asia, when you go there as a citizen of that country, are they going to let you in? For example, in the Philippines, you know, I am I have a citizenship, dual citizenship, Filipino citizenship, and is it okay for me to go to the Philippines and they are going to let me in when I go there?
I don't know the answer to that question. I will say I have heard from one of my clients who is from Central America and who speaks Spanish. And when he got to Central America, he did present both of his passports, his U.S. passport and his passport in from that country. And they smiled and let him enter. But I can't tell you that's all, what's going to always happen.
Yeah, okay. I will say this to you. It's very easy to find out. And, you know, and first of all, you know, the thing you have to remember is if you've got dual citizenship, you know, and you're a citizen of another country other than the United States, and unless there's a huge bar on that end, I don't think you're going to be, you know, you're going to be barred from entering the country. But the easy way to find out is to call the embassy. There's a Philippine embassy you can speak to. You can ask them. You can contact the Philippine government. Everything's set up on the internet to where it's easy access for you to ask those questions, and they will be answered. So you can do this ahead of time and get your answer before you travel.
Okay. It's very clear. Thank you so much for your information.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, Blas. Thank you for your questions. John, I see that your hand is up. John, can you please unmute yourself? There you go.
Thank you. Chance, just going back on your comment about where you launch from, if you're leaving, what's a SORNA compliant state? So if you leave in California and you take off on your airplane out of Frisco and you touch down and change planes, let's say in Dallas or Atlanta, does that become the SORNA compliant state you have to comply with, or is it from where you originally leaving from San Francisco?
Well, first of all, I think that you have to think in terms of complexity. It's where you're, you know, if you're stopping over somewhere, just because you stop over there doesn't necessarily mean that you have to adhere to whatever the rules and regulations are. It's good to check. It's always good to call an attorney and ask them, share your itinerary with them and tell them what you're going to do and see whether or not they think it's so. At first blush, it's wherever you're originating from, and it would be impossible to comply with any stopover because, you know, how are you going to do that? I mean, if you're going to comply with SORNA, you know, you have to comply like outside of 21 days. Okay. To begin with, you can't, you know, how do you know whether or not you're going to be able to stop over? That's canceled. You're going to stop over someplace. It just makes it incredibly ridiculous. So you just do your best from the origination to do what you need to do, with both state and federal. And, you know, I wouldn't worry so much about stopovers, but it's always good to share this and think about it ahead of time with an attorney. That's just that first blush. I'd have to look at it, and really think it through, but that's my first blush kind of thought.
I'd cut a little bit thinner too. Let's say your plane touches down and you change passengers out. You don't get off the plane. You never touch feet on the ground in whatever state you're in. I could see where that would fit with what you're saying, but let's say you have to get off the plane and you're going to sit there for, you know, have a layover for a couple hours. When we book our flights, we know pretty well in advance. I mean, we book them long in advance. I guess you could do it, you know, the week in advance, but we book our flights a good month in advance, so we would have time to comply with SORNA if that's what may be required.
At first blush and facially, I think no. I think absolutely not. But again, I think that this is more of a personal question of where you would share your agenda with your attorney and really think this thing through. But honestly, it sounds kind of funky to me and just, you know, too much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And I agree with Chance. some interesting comments over here. One of them says, just don't leave the airport. So. I think actually that's good advice. Yeah. I mean, it's different, folks, when you go to different countries. And, you know, Chance and I know the story of a gentleman who flew from the United States. He was flying to, I don't know, let's just say Yugoslavia. And, you know, he stopped at Heathrow Airport in London and they turned him around because the United Kingdom does not want you to be there. So they told him, we don't even want you in our airport. And he was sent back to the United States. It's the only time I've ever heard of that happening, and maybe that's why John asked that question. But I think domestically, that is not enough. You know, landing in their airport is not enough to trigger, sort of compliance. So let's move on. I don't see any other hand. Oops, there's another hand up. Mike, sorry about that. I almost missed you. Please, do you have a question or comment?
A couple of them. Number one, I'm from Illinois, so I don't have to deal with this exactly, I think. It was 20 years ago that I was that I offended and did a 10-year stint on the registry and no longer required to register. Are these IML regulations still something that I have to worry about? I'm about to reapply for a passport. When I first applied for one 10 years ago or so, there was none of this, so I didn't have any special markings on my passport, but I want to renew it. So just wondering what first thoughts are on that.
Well, my first thought is if you're not registered in any state, because there are some states like Florida that once you're on the registry, they don't take you off. But if you're not on any registry, then you don't have to have a unique identifier added to your passport. Okay. And you don't have to give 21-day notice. Okay. However, I have been told now by Department of Homeland Security that regardless of if you're no longer required to register, according to them, they're still looking at the manifest of all flights that start in the United States that fly overseas. And then they're checking that against some master list they have of everybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense. So, and if they find you there, supposedly they're going to send a notice to the country. And I say supposedly because that's what they told me in an email twice now. But I don't know if it really happens. It seems to me a heck of a lot of work to do that, but perhaps they're willing to do a heck of a lot of work, or they have some supercomputer somewhere that, you know, merges these fields, but I don't know.
Yeah, the whole idea of that, and, you know, they feel the federal government at least thinks that they can do that under IML. But they're not going to do that unless they see a pattern of activity that suggests that you are traveling for purposes of sexual trafficking. So if you're going to places that traditionally have a high amount of sexual trafficking, you know, if you're going to Mexico or you're going to Thailand or you're going to the Philippines, you're going to areas where there's a high level of sexual trafficking, and you were formerly on the register, or on the registry, they may send out a notice. But I've had discussions with the SMART office, and typically, you know, minus that, you know, for just general travel that where there's no established pattern, no, there's going to be no notice or slip sent out. So that's my understanding.
So for countries like Canada, who supposedly don't let you in if you have any felony, do you get stopped at the border? Do you not able to go in?
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to, because, you know, you're no longer a registrant now, but then there's the issue of whether or not you have a felony or a misdemeanor that would cause them to question whether or not you should enter based on that. So again, it's something I wouldn't analyze or look at here. But, you know, privately, you should probably contact an attorney after you study what the requirements are to any place you want to enter.
Right. And then the general question is, you keep saying talk to an attorney, and obviously attorneys specialize in different areas. So I'm a little bit, do I open up? Do I just go on the web and search for general attorneys near my zip code,
Well, not exactly. You know, what I'm suggesting here is maybe you call myself or Janice or someone who's kind of immersed in this kind of stuff and get an idea of, where you're going from that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And I really consider Chance to be an expert at overseas travel, Mike and others. So if you have an overseas travel question, I would recommend you call Chance. I'll do my best, but I think Chance knows more than I do. Okay, Mark, you got your hand up here?
I do. Did I unmute?
Yes, you did.
Are, because we're hearing okay. you.
You kind of double do it. Yeah, never mind. Won't explain.
Come on, Mark. Come on, Mark.
You got it. I put it in the chat, but the clarify again the after removal from California Registry 288A that the SORNA applying, and then also the second item, just any familiarity with the Mexico law since Mexico's so close. What's that based on the travel to their country? Thanks.
Sounds like a great question for Chance.
Well, you know, first of all, you can do the homework yourself by getting in touch with Mexico. But I will tell you this, and I haven't read what you wrote in here. But, you know, what exactly do you mean by the after requirement? That's what I like to know.
You were talking about not sort of not applying if you're off the registry, except in cases that were age based on original offense. So that I couldn't quite get out of whether SORNA applied or didn't apply to somebody off California registry. Or in some cases it still applied.
Okay. Well, that happens to be the issue with SORNA in particular and this case that is litigated. So, you know, it's a big gray area and this is quite an anomaly. For those people who are on the registry and registering right now, giving notice that they're going to travel and things like that, they're covered. But for people that are off the registry and, you know, looking at the SORNA rules and regulations, it's a big gray area. It's like, you know, can I travel? Under what circumstances can I travel? Do I still need to register? Do I need to comply with the classifications of SORNA? All these are up in the air. That's what the litigation is all about. So here's the thing. It kind of puts the kibosh or the freeze on people who have been removed from the registry in terms of travel. And I'm talking about people who have been relieved of the duty to register in California. It's gray and it's unknown. And so it kind of freezes out people who have benefited from the tiered system and been removed. So that's the answer to that. What's your second question?
That was you said I could check on the Mexico. I just thought there might be familiarity with if the thing that they had that was keeping me from going there, if it kicks in because of registration or because of past history, but if that's not clear, that's okay.
Okay.
And then, statement, I guess, guys, I'll kick in now. Chance is just amazing and using, you know, somebody the freedom after 37 years of being off the registry. I just got to state what it feels like in a difference in existing, feeling like a human being is amazing. I and somebody talking about picking from like the yellow pages or something. I had previously contacted a lawyer who took me for $8,000 and did nothing. So to, you know, I know at least working with Chance, you know, you're dealing with somebody who's, doing their job and very familiar. So, thanks for the blessing. But I'm going to stick around with this group. Thanks.
Thank you, Mark, and congratulations to you and to your attorney, Chance. Well done. All right, we've got another hand up, David. I'm asking you to unmute now. David, are you there?
There we go.
He's not unmuted. Oh, there we go.
Hi, David. No, I apologize. I'm not computer literate. So I also, like Mike, and was from Illinois, did my 10 years on the registry in Illinois, and I'm off. I renewed my passport for the first time, and I did not have the identifier in it. I want to address the Canada question. I have very good friends that live in Vancouver. I contacted two separate attorneys in Canada and asked them if I could now enter Canada, and they said no. That I will be turned away, that I will be turned around at the airport and sent back immediately to the United States. Even though I am off the registry, obviously done with probation, Canada, whether it's through Interpol or however, are going to be aware, and we still cannot enter the country. In addition, they made it very clear I believe Janice, you talked about it. I apologize. I don't know if it was Janice or Chance. They said, do not even change planes in Canada. So if I was going to fly, let's say, Air Canada from Portland, where I live, to Toronto to get to Western Europe and one of the Western Europe European countries, they said, don't do it. As soon as I landed, let's say in Toronto, I would again flag, and that's as far as I would get, and turn around. So your advice of always checking with an attorney and or an embassy and or a consulate is the best possible advice you can give, because it can be very expensive. You're going to pay for a plane ticket, and all you're going to get possibly is a few hours, and you're going to lose a lot of money, even off the registry. So again, Canada's, I'm so glad someone mentioned Canada. We still, or I, even I, still can't off the registry. Passport is clean, and the fact that I don't have the identifier, excuse me, I still cannot enter Canada, either as a tourist or even to change planes.
So, David, I'm gonna interrupt you because you're making some very universal statements, which I don't think are true. So we have a colleague. It's good news. We have a colleague who is a Canadian attorney. And he also spends part of his time in Florida. So in the chat room, I've given you his first name and his phone number.
Okay.
It's for everybody. If you want to travel to Canada, contact this man. And by the way, he's on the registry in Florida, but the Canadians gave him a bar license. You know, I don't understand that, but he understands the ins and out about travel to Canada. I will say one thing about Canada. I mean, I think it's awful that they're not allowing registrants, at least convicted of a felony sex offense, to enter, but it's my understanding, and nothing more than that, folks, I'm not an expert in Canadian law at all, but that Canadians, or the country of Canada, doesn't allow anybody in who's been convicted of any felony. So it's not just them discriminating against people convicted of a sex offense, okay? But I also understand that there's some administrative process that a Canadian attorney can help you get through those wickets and actually get be able to enter. But you have to go through a lawyer. They know the process. You're going to spend a few bucks. But if it's important for you to go to Canada, folks, then please contact the person that I've mentioned. I know that he's helped many people.
Okay. And just, I'm going to go off on do a 180 slightly. I have if anyone in the room is in Illinois and needs an outstanding attorney in Illinois, I have the name of someone who got me off probation, got me early probation, terminated my probation early, and works almost exclusively with us. I highly recommend him. So I'd be happy to give you his name and address for Illinois.
David? Would you put that over in the chat room, please, for many reasons? So we also have a colleague and a former Axel board member, Adele Nicholas, who's an attorney in Chicago.
Of course, absolutely.
And she kicks ass. What else am I going to say about Adele?
No. I was on the board. I was on the board. I was on Illinois Voices with her. I was a board member, so I know. I just now live in Oregon. But, yes, I know Adele quite well.
Yeah. So there's certainly more than one qualified attorney in Illinois. I'm happy to report. David obviously knows one of them, and one of them was able to help him get off the registry. And that's fantastic. So there are other people too. And Adele Nicholas, by the way, Adele is going to be one of our speakers on October 1st. And she's going to be talking about a really significant victory that she won at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And one of the things I love about that decision, quite frankly, is the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals reversed itself. Listen to that. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals reversed itself. They said before, oh, well, we believe the nonsense of the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course, they didn't use that language. And they said, oh, yeah, sure. You know, you state of Illinois, you want to do that. No problem. But the Seventh Circuit reversed itself. It has to do with a town in the state of Wisconsin that all of a sudden said, oh, you know what? We're going to limit the number of people on the registry who live in our town. What? It's a great decision. And again, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, this is at the federal level, folks. There's one level beneath the U.S. Supreme Court, and they cried nonsense and said, no, we're reversing ourselves. This is not constitutional, or it is unconstitutional. Okay, John, you've got your hand up. I think it might be the same John as before, but I'm not sure.
Yes, it is. And I don't want to be a boinger, but talking about hiring lawyers off the internet, I took a step farther before I contracted with Janice to file my appeal or my petition. But I talked to my my defense lawyer who handled my case, he wasn't handling these, and he said, here's a guy to handle it in your county. I contacted that guy. He said, well, here, fill out this paperwork. Before he wanted to talk about what experience he had, wouldn't give me any information on his experience. Turned out he had none. And he started talking really a bunch of hooey about how all this worked out. He said, automatically, you're going to get off. No questions asked. There's nothing to worry about. Well, I've been sitting in on these meetings for a few years now with Axol, and he's not informed. Even lawyers who are recommended by possibly your defense lawyer are not entirely credible when it comes to how to deal with getting off the registry and other, I'm just going to say other issues dealing with sex offenses, because if he gives me that kind of information, it gives me absolutely no confidence in this person to do what I need him to do. Just sharing that for everybody else.
Yeah. Thank you, John. And there's a reason that Chance and I are as knowledgeable as we are. And this is it. Chance and I went and lobbied for this bill. Okay. We lobbied for tiered registry law. In our organization, we lobbied for almost 7 years, folks, before we got a tiered registry law. We didn't get the law that we asked for. We asked for a law that was based, quite frankly, that was based upon current risk level. But instead, we got a law that was based upon your conviction offense. It's not a perfect law. And by the way, maybe this is a great time, Chance, to bring up the fact that Axol will, in fact, be lobbying early next year here in Sacramento. And every single person on the call today and who's listening afterwards, you are invited to join Chance and I here in Sacramento, because we were told a couple of years ago, not now, come back in 2023, and we the legislature, we will review the tiered registry law and what needs to be fixed. There's a lot of things that need to be fixed. For example, why is every felony CP offense on tier 3, right? Makes no sense. It's a non-contact, non-violent offense, and yet you're up there with somebody who's, you know, violently raped 10 people. Makes no sense. So it was we know it was a political compromise. And the fact that it makes no sense to me means it's going to be easier to topple it. But we'll see. We've got to get the legislature. But again, you're on early notice now in January and February of next year. We're only talking about 4 months away from now. We're going to ask you, we want you to join us here in Sacramento to talk to our legislators and their staff about these changes to the registry. And if you're on the registry and you're assigned to Tier 3 in particular, you really should be there. Okay, enough for that commercial. Scott, you've got your hand up. Please join us.
Yes, hello. Hello, everybody. First of all, let me thank you and Chance for riding this roller coaster of trying to get into these, into the SORNA courtroom. I'm sure it's quite frustrating, but we're all in it with you. I understand the meeting here, or your meetings have quite a heterogeneous audience, not people in the California state and out of state, people who are currently on registration, and people who, thanks to you, Janice, who are now off of the registration. So I just wanted to ask a question, and it may not be a clear one. Now that I am off registration for an offense that did not include a minor, do I still need to fill out this 21-day notice if I go to a foreign country?
There's a really quick answer to your question, Scott. The answer is no. Okay.
Okay.
So the fact is that if somebody like Scott has been removed from the registry, you're no longer required to give a 21-day notice. You're also no longer required to have a unique identifier added to your passport. However, as has been said and bears repeating, as the Department of Homeland Security says, they're still going to send a notice to any country to which you travel. I've got this bold assertion out there. That's what they say they're going to do. I don't know if they're actually going to do it. I haven't heard of it happening to anybody yet, and I hope it never happens. But if they have, as I said earlier, some supercomputer that can look at the manifest of every flight, get this, every overseas flight that starts in the United States, that they're comparing that list to some grand list that they have of people on the registry. And I mean, what do you do when somebody's got the name John Smith or Bob, you know, Bob Dole? I mean, there's a lot of people with similar names. So my gosh, I mean, it seems to me unwieldy and maybe impossible to do that, but they said that they're at least reserving the right to do them. But Scott, you don't have to give a 21-day notice, and you don't have to have a unique identifier added to your passport.
Okay. My interest is traveling to Mexico, and I understand the problem may be not a sex registrant history, but actually a felony history, just like it is to go to Japan. Do you have an associate lawyer who represents Mexico that I can ask these kind of questions to?
You know, Scott and everybody else who's listening and watching, there's a person, I'm thinking about Paul Rigney Chance. So Paul Rigney is in contact with an attorney in Mexico. I mean, that attorney lives and works in Mexico, I believe, is licensed in Mexico. So one line in the chat room, do you have access to the chat room?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so I will give you Paul Rigney's contact information, and why don't you go ahead and contact him directly, okay?
Yes, I'm lucky that I also have a Mexican consulate in my city. Should I also check with them, or is that a reliable source of info?
I'd start with Paul, quite frankly, because I know he actually invested some money and paid this attorney in Mexico. I really don't know where their research is right now. Maybe Chance does.
Start with Paul, and you know, if that doesn't work out, you know, it's always good to talk to the consulate, and you know, see where you're at then, and then you might want to bounce your ideas off of counsel, which is, you know, either Janice or I.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And hang in there for the SORNA day. Thank you.
You're welcome. Safe travels to you, Scott. Well, we had a lot of questions today about international travel. I think it's time to move to domestic travel because I don't see any hands up. And of course, we want to save time to talk about tiered registry law. So when it comes to domestic travel, man, it's like a minefield out there, right? And the reason that I say that is because it's easy to step on one of these landmines, which comes in the form of a state requirement that you register there when you're just visiting. Now, the triggers are set at from 24 hours in the state of Rhode Island. I think the longest period of time might be Hawaii, which is 14 days, I think, off the top of my head. But the fact is that at some point in time, if you're on the registry and you travel to another state, it's possible you'll have to register in that other state. And the reason that Chance and I, time after time, recommend you do not register in another state is when it comes to getting off the registry. So, like, I am working with somebody right now who I helped get off the California registry, but he's still registered in Florida, right? And so the benefits of him getting off the California registry are much smaller because he's still registered in the state of Florida, right? So in other words, congratulations, you don't have to go in every year and, you know, ruin your birthday every year. But the fact is, you still are going to have to, he's going to have to get a unique identifier added to his passport, and he's going to have to get 21-day notice before he travels overseas. And that's what we're talking about. And if only he weren't, you know, required to travel, I mean, to register in Florida, it wouldn't be there. And by the way, Florida is not the only other state. The other state that I'm well aware of is New York State. So again, in New York, if you're ever registered in New York, they never take you off their registry. Okay. So when Chance and I give you information about domestic travel, we're trying to help you avoid registering in another state. That's what it's all about. Okay. Folks, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You're like, oh, well, I can go to Las Vegas for 5 days. Who's going to know? I'm going to go. I'm going to drive my car there. I'm going to pay for the hotel in cash and blah, blah, blah. Well, what if you get in a traffic accident, right? Next thing they're going to know, ask for is, where's your license? You know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, how long have you been here? You know, and unfortunately, it's your fifth day. Well, off you go to, you know, jail, possibly, at least get arrested, and then charged with a failure to register, which is going to cost you time and money. And then you're going to be on the, you know, the Nevada registry. So again, Chance and I are trying to help you avoid that. Another example, remember I brought up Rhode Island, it's 24 hours. Well, when it comes to Rhode Island, the good news is it's a really small state, right? So if you're going to go visit Aunt Sally in Rhode Island, then get a hotel outside of Rhode Island. The states around Rhode Island have longer periods of time before you're required to register. So please think about it before you do this. You know, don't just say, I'm just going to ignore all these things and hope and pray that they don't find me. That's really not much of a plan. I think a lot of people have been born as a result of that lack of planning. So, and we're not talking about procreation here, of course, but we're talking about trying to keep you out of jail and trying to keep you away from a failure to register or, quite frankly, registration in the first place. Chance, you want to add to that?
Well, just think about domestic travel like a cross between two games, say Monopoly and Jumanji. Okay. If you think about it that way, then you'll understand how to approach it. The idea is that, you know, every roll of the dice, presents new challenges, and you need to figure out how to deal with those challenges to avoid going to jail and, you know, having to pay for it, the consequences. So, you know, the idea is you want to stay completely compliant, but you don't want to register anywhere. And so when you travel domestically, you know, think of all these concentric zones. These are state lines and places you're going to go. Build an itinerary and check out each one so that you know how long you can stay and how long, you know, and then a plan accordingly so that if you want to stay in a place longer, you may want to stay there just long enough to where you don't have to register, exit the state, and then go back. You know, you need to know how each state works and how many aggregate days you can stay there. So it takes planning. But if you plan it out and you know what you're doing, then it's a stress-free trip and you enjoy it and you're compliant and you come back happy. And again, it's a cross between Monopoly and Jumanji, but you know, you'll be able to do it. That's my take on it.
Yeah, thank you for that comparison. I talk about minefields. He talks about Monopoly. I'd rather play Monopoly. Okay, so if you have a question or a comment here about domestic travel, this is the time to put your hand up. You can wave to us if you're on, if your video is on. If not, you can do it electronically there using the reactions button. I'm scanning, and I don't see in our two screens here anybody that has a question or a comment. So, oh, wait, somebody does. There, Michael.
Fletcher.
Okay, Michael. You're muted, Michael. Can you unmute yourself? Still,
you're still. Got to unmute there. Otherwise, you've got to mime it out.
There you go.
Mime it. I just wanted to make a comment, in fact, about traveling to Oregon. I traveled to Oregon probably a year and a half ago or so. And I contacted the state police and you know, all the actual Oregon Voices or whoever it was for the registry. And right. To make sure while I was there that I'm not overstepping any boundaries and I won't be subjecting myself to anything. And I talked to the state police person in charge of it, a really nice man, by the way. I said, is there a time limit I need to know about being here? Because I'm helping my daughter winterize her trailer and all that. And he said, no, we don't have a time limit. He says, you know, just, you're not going to stay here, are you? I said, no. And, you know, so he was really nice. But as far as he told me that there was no time limit when you travel there if you're on vacation. And my concern was, you know, leaving California and then you know, what's happening in California? What would they say? But I was there about 14 days, I think, like that or a little more. But I just wanted to make that comment. And then later I'd like to talk to you, Janice, or on the phone sometime about my particular situation here. Last time I think we spoke personally was at lunch in Sacramento and I had my friend with me. I was going to ask you something. It's been a while. I was going to ask you something. It's been pretty dire, but you asked the very first and most important question. Are you represented by counsel? Yes, I was. I'm not now. And things are not really good for me. And I have an estate that I'm going to lose to that litigation. And it's pure fraud. And so I need to talk to you about that. I don't know what to do.
Let me, Call me during the week, Michael. Just call me during the week, okay?
Perfect. Okay, thank you very much. And I'll mute back out, and I'm going to go for a minute to get lunch real quick.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye. Okay, so I'm going to mention a case that's pending very quickly in case you all are so curious about the juror's case. We filed a lawsuit basically challenging a state law that said that people convicted of felonies can serve on a jury. That's a big change. Our Constitution used to say if anybody convicted of a felony could not serve on a jury. And then they passed Senate Bill 310 that said, oh, well, we're changing our mind. We're going to change the Constitution. People convicted of a felony can, in fact, serve on a jury unless you've been convicted of a felony sex offense, right? So just to remind you what this lawsuit's about, we cry nonsense or BS or a longer word to that because there's no reason. You're going to say it's okay to have a murderer on your jury, but you can't have somebody convicted of murder, but you can't have somebody convicted of a felony sex offense, which might in fact be possession of child pornography. So we have been working on this for a long time, this lawsuit, and we filed the last appellate brief in April. So here it is, 5 months later, and we're still waiting for an answer from the appellate court. So the trial court granted a demurrer because the trial court judge did not want to make an unpopular decision, I'm sure, and so said, no, you know, the case is dismissed. And so the next step was to appeal it. We appealed it. This appellate court, by the way, has a terrible reputation. It's in that it's always late. And so I'm not surprised we haven't gotten a decision after 5 months. I'm hoping and praying, quite frankly, that by the end of December of this year, not next year, but this year, that we will in fact have a decision. Now, I've talked to many of you, and some of you said, I don't want to serve on a jury. I understand that position. But what we're trying to do in this case is we're trying to give you the right to serve on a jury. Then you can tell the judge the reasons why you shouldn't be on a jury. Now, the other thing is, quite frankly, is what in fact a prosecutor, right, allow you to serve on a jury. I think it's highly unlikely, but the fact is that you should be given the right. And how about somebody who's charged with a sex offense? Shouldn't somebody who's already been through the whole process be, you know, it's a jury of your peers. Shouldn't you be on that jury? I think Chance might have something to add to that.
Well, no, I always look at ways to get off a jury. And I'd be thankful if I had an automatic one, but you know, for those who really are interested in doing this, it goes beyond just your want to be a good citizen. It really is about being acknowledged as a citizen and not allowing the government to create a subculture of people that just, you know, but for that can't do anything. So it's really important to assert that right, whether you want to or not, because, you know, in the end, you know, you want a fair playing field, and that's what really this is all about.
And folks, if you looked at the legislative history of this bill, Senate Bill 310, which I have many times, there's 10 legislative reports, 10, and not one of those reports mentions a reason as to why somebody convicted of a sex offense should not serve on a jury. Not even one of them. There's not one word in any of those 10 legislative histories. And so, you know, we think that without a sound reason for excluding registrants, then registrants should not be excluded. We filed this. Our legal claim, by the way, is equal protection. So equal protection under the law, we have it in our state constitution. It's also in the federal constitution. And so we're hopeful that we will be successful on that legal claim because we hope to apply if we're successful on that legal claim, then we plan to apply it to a case involving the tiered registry law. And that in fact has to do with people who've been convicted of a felony CP offense. Okay. Now being assigned to tier three. Okay. So Martin, you've got your hand up.
Yes, sir. I don't know if this is something I should discuss here. So I called Chance's office last week. He may not have gotten the message, but I was confronted with this situation, and my felony had been reduced to a misdemeanor. And I called the jury office, and they said, "Sounds like you're fine." So I registered for jury duty, mm-hmm. Still feeling very apprehensive, because again, it says convicted, not reduced. So I just need to be calmed down. The service is over. I didn't have to show up. Not that I would want to show up having been in a courtroom, but still I do want to participate as a citizen, even having made the mistakes I made.
Sure. Well,
the answer I think clearly is that you're no longer a felon, you know, for all purposes. So if the felony is barring you, that's one thing. Other than the registration, and if it's the registration that's going to preclude you, that's the issue that Janice is talking to. I think Janice is pretty clear on that.
Yeah, I think this is a really important case based on principles. And again, this whole idea about equal protection is really important to members of the registrant community. And we're here to fight for your rights, and that's an important right. And if we can get this court to agree that's an equal protection claim, then we in fact will use this appellate decision as a precedent in other cases. So let's go ahead and move on to another case. Whoops, wait a minute, got a hand up here. Is that Martin? Did you just speak? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm trying to put my hand down. Thank you.
Okay. It's okay. Yeah. These systems are great to use when they work and when we know how to work them properly, but yeah, there's room for some wiggle room for other choices. Okay. So let's talk about the tiered registry law, because there's good news to report and then there's not so good news to report. So I like the good news first. Here we go. According to the California Department of Justice, they just made this report to this California Sex Offender Management Board on Thursday, 2 days ago. They said that 3,984 petitions have been filed in the state of California under the tiered registry law. And of that total, 2,012 have been granted. That's a little more than half. Only 174 of them have been denied or dismissed, and there's 1,798 petitions that are pending. So in other words, they've been filed, but there's no decision yet about grant, dismiss, or deny. So on the surface, it sounds like that's swell, okay? Basically, we've been doing this now for 14 months, the petitioning process, and about 4,000 petitions have been filed. But I want to tell you, it's actually terrible news. And the reason it's terrible news is because our best guess, this is less than 10% of the people who are eligible to petition. Okay. And we don't know why people are not petitioning. If anybody is on the call today and has not petitioned, would you please put your hand up? We'd like to hear from you, because Chance and I are scratching our heads going, how do we get this, the word out? And I see one hand already up. I see you, Carlos, just a minute. So, we have a robust website. We talk about petitions on a regular basis. We have these monthly meetings. We talk about this process all the time in the monthly meetings. But, you know, the question really is, and here's some more hands. That's good. What is it about this process that is causing you not to file a petition? So, Carlos, your hand went up first. Could you please unmute yourself?
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, yes. I actually have a misdemeanor myself.
Okay.
And, have tried to go down avenues to get the information petitioning, and I'm new to your site, new to the information of that site. So that was one of the questions I was going to ask you anyway. So Janice, thank you for answering that. You do have the information. Apparently I've been missing it. Of course, I've been going to the public defender's office here locally, and they have actually been negative in giving me information.
Carlos, can I stop you there? What county do you live in?
This is Riverside County.
I'm sorry, but not surprised. Okay.
Yes. Well, as the public defender's office has become a lot less in representing people because of the staff. They just don't have people to handle the cases, let alone the attention to give somebody if they're just calling, inquiring. There used to be a time that they were helping me out and they would answer questions so I could go down to their office. But it seems like this is the only place right now that I can follow through, possibly contacting you in the next week or two to be able to talk to you specifically about my case.
Yeah, talk to me, Ernest, or Chance. Yeah, Carlos, both Chance and I are working on petition cases and that, so please contact one or both of us, and we're definitely here to help you. I think you said you were convicted of a misdemeanor. Can you tell me what that is? Do you know the penal code section?
Yeah, it's a 288C. It was originally a felony. It's a wobbler. So it was reduced. It was reduced.
Yeah. We have bad news for you. Have you gotten a tier assignment yet?
Yeah, it already is a 3.
Yeah. So I'm not surprised because right now that's what California DOJ is doing. We have a lawsuit pending about that issue. Okay. So California DOJ is not giving you the credit for the reduction. All right. And they're saying anybody who's ever been convicted of felony 288C1, then you're on tier 3. And there's no reason, there's no way for you to get off. So understand it doesn't make sense for you to submit a petition right now or any attorney to do it on your behalf. Let this lawsuit happen as it's going to happen. The rose is blooming. I don't know, whatever analogy, my tomato's ripening. I'm a gardener, you can tell. So the fact is that until we have this decision, it's going to be your petition will be dismissed.
Yes, as my first attempt was some time ago.
Okay.
Before the tier system came into effect. So obviously it's going to be a hurdle that, like you're disclosing, that is a case situation that is being fought right now, and that's my only hope. Unfortunately, when people bring me up on the internet and they first find out it's a sexual offense that I have charged, they look at the worst part of it. Somehow, I don't think it's disclosed on the internet, the actual tier position. So they see, oh, wait a minute, you're in the most offensive of all of the tiers. And it's causing issues down the road that literally lead into decision on me going to church.
I understand. I do.
So it's causing more harm than it's ever caused. As I thought I was making momentum to reduce this and following through, it's actually created a giant China wall that I can't get around.
So Carlos, I'm very sympathetic, empathetic, and compassionate about your situation. And that's why I sued the bastards. Okay. And I mean it. So I've had 2 lawsuits pending. And unfortunately, the first one, another attorney jumped in front of me or got there first. In Sacramento County, and she lost the case. All right. So what we had to do, a pivot. We filed a second lawsuit, and that was in Sacramento County. So we filed a second lawsuit in LA County, and that one is still pending. And so she, the other attorney in the first case, is trying to get it up to review by the state Supreme Court. Okay. Whether or not this makes sense, but they don't necessarily have to grant review. So we're watching that one very carefully. But in the meantime, it's on a parallel track. This case that's now pending in Los Angeles. And I believe I have a hearing date on October. Okay. In that case. And trust me, we will report about it on the website. But folks, if you are convicted of 288C, you're assigned to tier 3, and there's just nothing we can do to help you until we get the litigation fixed or, you know, a positive decision on 288C, or we get the legislature to change the law, which would make sense, right? I mean, Carlos, you had a felony that was reduced to misdemeanor. Therefore, you shouldn't be treated like a felon for all kinds of purposes, including this one. And California DOJ is supposed to be really stubborn, and that's why we had to sue them.
Well, anything I could do to participate in whatever it's going to take to get this change, obviously, I will talk to you somewhere during the week.
Okay,
we will concur with that. So thank you for answering my questions.
You're welcome. Thank you. Chance, I think maybe you might want to add a comment or reply to part of Carlos's comment about going to church.
Well, nothing should ever stop you from going to church, ever. And I'm going to say this, and I sincerely mean it. You know, a church is for all those who wish to worship and believe. So if it's precluding you from going to a specific church, perhaps it's not you that's at fault. Perhaps it's your church. Find a better place, because this should not bar you at all. And I see your hands up. Go right ahead. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, here's the dilemma. You know, there's always going to be a situation in the church where you have someone, family member, husband or wife, therefore family, children, who are going through, let's say, a divorce or some court case. And their attorney is a kind of attorney that is certainly a shark in looking for reasons why they shouldn't be attending church, and they see Carlos. In other words, they're doing research to see who participates at church and if there are any sex offenders in the church. And if they find one, they say, wait a minute, why are you going to a church and threatening your children with somebody that's in that church and want to portray her as, let's just say, someone who is not taking care of her children, and therefore, a dilemma is there that either they leave the church, that family leaves the church because of that threat, or I leave the church to not present that threat.
Well, you know, I understand what you're talking about, but these are apples and oranges. Okay. Because, you know, that's something that happens out there in the world, and we're talking about worship. The choices you make are the choices you make. And if you don't want to rock the boat or cause any kind of discomfort where you're at because you have personal reasons, I understand. But all I'm saying is do not let ever your status, you know, as a registrant, you know, ever preclude you from taking part in any church, any place. And don't let anybody do that. If a church does that, if a church does that, it's the wrong kind of church to go to. If people in the world get involved and they start making you feel uncomfortable, or they create a situation where you've got to make choices, you know, I think that you know what to do. But as far as a church goes, no church, if it's a real church, is going to preclude you on the basis of that status. That's where I'm coming from.
And I echo everything Chance just said about the churches. I mean, I am a Christian myself, and I believe in redemption, and I believe in forgiveness. Gosh, gee whiz, what if I didn't? I don't think I'd be doing the work I'm doing today, right? So the fact is, I you know, what Chance just said is, if a church acts this way, to me, they're not a Christian church. Because if you say, I'm a Christian, then you believe in redemption and forgiveness, and everybody can be saved. So I'll get off my soapbox. I'm not a biblical scholar, by the way, everybody, just to let you know, but I have some strong views there. Rick, you've had your hand up in quite a while. Do you have a comment or a question for us?
Yes, I'm still not assigned to a tier here in California.
Oh, good.
My last registration officer at LAPD said she thought that would happen in this coming January. So that means I really can't apply, doesn't it, to get off?
So, Rick, when I said, oh, good, I don't mean so good for you. I mean, it's good that you brought the issue up, because this is the deal, folks. The tiered registry law says that the California DOJ was supposed to have every tier assigned in January of last year. Not this year, last year, January 21. Okay. And then it said, oh, well, if you're having a little trouble figuring out somebody's tier, we're going to give you up to an additional 24 months. That clock runs out on January 1 of 23 next year. We're talking about less than 4 months from now. And I want to tell you that Axol is poised and ready to strike in January of 2023 when California DOJ has not met their deadline. We're suing them. Okay, so we're well aware of this deadline. We're well aware of what we're going to do, and we're sharpening our knives to do it. And I say that knowing that California DOJ is an agency full of attorneys, and so it takes some gumption, shall we say, as my grandmother used to say, gumption, to sue an agency full of attorneys. But we've done it once before. We were successful once before, and I believe we'll be successful again, because it's a travesty. It really is. So, Rick, what you just talked about, you don't have a tier assignment, and you're right, you can't file a petition, or if you do, it's going to be dismissed, okay? It will just be dismissed, because it'll say, you don't have a tier assignment. Okay, in the beginning, I filed some petitions when there was no tier assignment, and the law doesn't say you have to have a tier assignment. So much of this is based on nonsense, and I'm being kind, okay? Because think about this. The law passed in 2017, This is like ancient history. 5 years ago, the law passed, right? 5 years ago. And after the law passed, the California Department of Justice got 60 new employees. 60. Can you imagine what you could do with 60 new employees? Because they're the ones that are supposed to implement the tiered redundancy law, right? Well, what have those employees been doing for five freaking years that they don't have every tier assigned? None. We don't know. I really don't know. And I know as a real life example, Frank Lindsay, my former plumber, who's the one who basically raised my consciousness and awareness about this issue, he was convicted in 1979. You know how long that is? That's a long time ago, 1979. And they haven't assigned his tier yet. It makes me crazy. I filed a petition on his behalf, and what do you know? The San Luis Obispo Superior Court, they bounced it. I'm like, nope, we're not doing this. The law doesn't require tier assignment. Chance and I can assign most people's tiers in 10 minutes or less, right? We'll just ask you a series of questions. As long as you answer us truthfully, we can give you a real educated guess about what tier you should be assigned to. Like Frank Lindsay, he should be assigned to tier 2. I sent my assistant to Orange County where Frank was convicted. We have a copy of Frank's record. What the heck is holding up the California Department of Justice that they can't assign Frank's tier? I don't know. I mean, maybe Frank was a plaintiff in too many cases or something, too many of our cases, and they don't like him. It's possible. They put him at the bottom of the end basket. Whatever it is, folks, just know that we are ready. We are ready, and we are going to sue California DOJ next January. Because I will tell you, dollars to no donuts or whatever you want to bet here, and nickels. The fact is, they're not going to meet their deadline, and we're going to sue them. And Frank Lindsay's probably going to be our plaintiff, at least one. But anybody else, Rick, or anybody else that's on here today or listening later, if you want to be a plaintiff in that lawsuit, just let me know, because we're going to file a lawsuit. Chance, maybe you have something to add to that.
Yeah, I think I'm the only lawyer in California that's ever gotten a TDD granted.
Yes, I've
never heard of it since then. I've had a lot of people contact me and ask me how that happened. And it kind of goes to this question. In your case, you have an out-of-state conviction, I assume, right? And so it's a different set of variables.
It was federal only, and apparently I didn't violate any California law.
Well, yeah, the thing is that, it's one thing when it's an out-of-state and you're asking a court to take a look, because when they generate the report, it's hard to make exactly what it is you're convicted of, because then it gets into the area of having to define what that is instead of the DOJ. When you have a conviction within California, everybody knows what it is. So let's just say that you're a TDD in California and you have a conviction that's obvious. Like, just say it's a misdemeanor, something or other, to get you on tier one. And, you know, we can look at the record. We can look at, we can compare it with what you're convicted with. And we don't need the DOJ to tell us exactly what tier you've landed on, because we can see it right in front of our faces, just like Frank Lindsay's case. One court in particular was reasonable enough to understand that and apply it. And a TBD came off the registry. Okay, and I thought that was pretty good. I have other cases that are TBDs that are pending, and you know, the issue is, you know, is it an out of state conviction versus an in state? But your position is a little bit more complicated because it requires a lot more. But yes, Janice is right. Courts are hesitant, if not just outright not going to do it until the DOJ makes the definition. And here's the real twist to all this. Let's just say they do. And there are some district attorneys in the counties that compose California that will argue that the facts and circumstances warrant a different designation and that the DOJ is wrong, and they will take it a hearing on that. It's just really weird. They won't move unless you're designated. And once you are, if they disagree with it because of the facts and circumstances, they'll take it a hearing. It's a weird thing.
And so, Chance, I have one of those cases now myself. I know you had one first, and now I have one where basically the district attorney is saying, oh, I know more than the state government knows, which is right. Nonsense.
Nonsense is right. So, you know, but I'm saying you can't win. So, you know, the thing is you can't. The good news about the numbers Janice reported was is that you know, most of these petitions are very successful. There's just a really minute number that aren't. And that, you know, and the, what's happening here are, I don't know if you've ever watched the movie Jurassic Park, where the dinosaur kind of feels around the edges to see where on the perimeter they can find a soft spot. You know, that's what's happening right now within the law. You know, the prosecutors are busily trying to find a soft spot. But, you know, the idea here is that I think judges are, you know, most of which who study this are squarely on the side of applying this law fairly and evenly. And we've gotten a lot of good results. So stay tuned. I think we're in the right direction.
Yeah. Thank you, Chance, for that. And folks, I'll just share a couple of anecdotes with you about a couple of my petitions that I now have pending. One of them is a woman on the registry in LA County. She offended more than 30 years ago. She's had a clean record for 30 years. And the DA in that particular courthouse in LA County objected to her petition. And when I called the deputy DA to talk to him about the case, my first question was, why? Why did you object to this petition? And his answer was the following, and I'm quoting, because we can. So when Chance talks about the DAs here trying to test the system, some of the DAs trying to test some of the system, that's just an example. And so I don't know how Chance feels about it, but I take the position that, this gives me an opportunity to educate a judge. The judge doesn't understand. So let me explain the tiered registry law to the judge. And really, judges are busy people too, and they have lots of different cases. But the whole reason that the tiered registry came into being is because the state government realized that there's too many people on the registry, and that, guess what? Too many resources were being used following people who didn't pose a current danger. I mean, really, that's the rationale for the tiered registry law. So what did these DAs think they're doing when they're saying, we don't agree? Right? Or, oh yeah, I don't care that somebody's led a peaceful life, law-abiding citizen for 30 plus years. We're going to object to the petition, quote, because we can. Now, I will tell you, I've only had one of those cases so far that I've taken to court where the DA objected to the petition. And guess what? I won. And I tell you what, I'm going to frame this decision because in the decision, the judge said the DA did not meet their burden of proof. Okay, so like the woman that I just mentioned, this was a man. He'd been on the registry for 25 plus years. He'd been a law-abiding citizen for 25 plus years. And I had, you know, lots of his letters of support. He had a, you know, psychological evaluation done just for this purpose. All this thing, we put this together and we showed it to the judge. And the judge again said, the DA did not meet their burden of proof. And what he meant by that is the DA, in order to object to your petition, has to say the following. There's a box that they check. And this is what the box says. This person should be required to continue registration because if they do, that will, quote, significantly enhance community safety. And this is the rub. The law does not define significantly enhance, and it doesn't define community safety. So here Chance and I are, we're in the wilderness, we're in the jungle with our machetes, right, cutting down the weeds and trying to establish a path to what the heck that means. And at least one judge in Placer County, by the way, had this spine in the backbone to say, DA, you didn't prove this. You did not prove that community safety would be significantly enhanced by this man continuing to register. It's a beautiful decision. It's a short decision. I'll take it to the bank every day that I can, and I have about three more coming up in the next probably 6 weeks. And I hope that the judges in different counties before different judges, I hope these judges will be just as wise as the judge in Placer County. So do we have any questions about the petitioning process or the tiered registry law? This is a time to put up put up your hand, please, and let us know that you have a question. Oh, there goes a hand right away. Martin. Is that Marty?
Martin. No, not Marty. Okay. Martin. Hi. There was a conversation we were briefly having on chat about having our tiers reduced from tier 3 to tier 1 and then having it removed altogether. And as I understand it, those offenses cannot be forgiven completely, not forgiven, what am I trying to say? Removed completely. Terminated, right, that tier one is as far as you can go.
Right. Nobody under the tiered registry law, nobody automatically gets off the registry. Nobody. Okay.
And you can't petition to get off the registry.
Yes, you can. Certainly. Okay. If you've been assigned to either tier one or tier two, yes, you can in fact petition for removal, depending on if you meet the other eligibility requirements. So for example, if you're on parole, probation, or supervised release for any reason, you cannot. That makes you ineligible. You have to wait until parole, probation, or supervised release is over. Okay. It's probably why I have a greater number of people seeking early termination of supervised release than I've ever had before. Because all of a sudden people are like, supervised release is not so bad. I'm on this maintenance program, blah, blah, blah. But it makes them ineligible to petition for removal. There's some other things too, like the number of years, like tier one, it's a minimum of 10 years. But in fact, if you've been convicted of failure to register, then that adds more years before you're eligible. So there's different things that might make you ineligible, even though you've made that minimum number of years of registration. So this is where Martin and everybody else who's listening to this, please contact an attorney. Contact an attorney like Chance, like me, who knows what they're talking about. There are people out there who are saying things that, making promises that they cannot deliver on. Okay, so I've seen some of their mailings. I don't know how they make, they're making a bundle, obviously, that they can afford to send out letters to everybody on the registry or whoever their target group is. And one of the letters was so bad, I actually picked up the phone and I called the lawyer and said, "How dare you?" And I didn't threaten to call the Bar Association, but I said, if you don't change this, then maybe I have to contact the Bar Association. Because again, he was making promises that he couldn't deliver upon, and also claiming before the petitioning process started that he'd already gotten several people off the registry under that tiered registry law, which was not even possible. So when people do that, then yeah. So be careful when you choose an attorney. And by the way, Chance and I, we made a webinar. It's on the website here. We made a webinar. So some people feel comfortable filing their own petition, preparing their own petition, filing their own petition. If you do, that's great. But please, if you file your own petition and the DA's office objects your petition, you need to hire a lawyer. You do not want to go in there on your own, because you will be chopped up into little bitty pieces and you may never get off the registry. That's an exaggeration, okay? They're not going to do that literally. But the fact is, they can basically make you wait another 5 years before you can submit your petition again. So you need to have legal representation at a hearing. Again, only, this is if the DA objects. And by the way, I know there's a gentleman from Riverside who said Riverside, District Public Defender's Office would not help him, but there are people in most counties, not all counties, but in most counties, in the Public Defender's Office who will help you in the petitioning process. Chance, would you like to add to that?
Make sure you understand where you are in the process. Maybe make sure you know what you've been convicted of. Make sure what your designation is. Make sure that you are aware of how long you've been registering and what date you become eligible. And if you just know those things, whenever you speak to an attorney and you provide them with that information, will make the whole process so much easier. Be able to provide that attorney with your background. Have you been convicted of other things? If so, when and for what? So, when you approach this, know your situation and then pick somebody who's fairly reliable. I have people that call me all the time about attorneys who promise them the moon, and they tell me exactly what it is they're trying to do for them, and it's impossible because it can't be done. And they're paying thousands of dollars for it. So, be careful. Sometimes it's good to check the attorney's background, see if they've ever been disciplined for things like that. I mean, you're out there shopping, so be diligent about who you choose and who represents you.
So true, so true. So folks, I've mentioned the fact that we have at least one lawsuit that's pending that's challenging part of the tiered registry law. We actually have more than one. We have three. So another one that we have has to do with people convicted of an attempt of some sort, an attempted sex offense. Folks, in my opinion, everybody who was convicted of an attempt belongs on tier one. But unfortunately, we have people who were convicted of attempts and they're in tier three. Okay. That's what this lawsuit is about. People who attempted a sex offense, at least that's what they're convicted of. And the fact is they've now been assigned to tier three. So this lawsuit says that's not right. These folks should be assigned to tier one and not to tier three. Another one that we have is, and we kind of discussed it earlier about people who have a felony reduced to a misdemeanor. And then, you know, California DOJ is assigned into tier three. It's like, no, you're not supposed to be doing that, but they're still doing it. So one of them is Penal Code Section 288.2. So get this. If somebody's convicted of a felony 288.2, which is a wobbler, and not all felonies can be reduced to misdemeanors, but many of them can. Well, when you get that reduction on a 288.2, it's not just that you go down to tier one. You're not supposed to register at all. Okay. A misdemeanor 288.2, there's no registration requirement. Get that one. And yet, what is California DOJ doing? They're assigning those people to tier three, the highest tier. Oh my goodness, that just doesn't make any sense to me. So we're going to keep filing lawsuits because right now there's no other way for us to address the issue that the tiered registry law is in need of improvement. Man, I'm so happy that we have a tiered registry law. I'm so happy that 2012 petitions have been granted so far in the state. That's fabulous. But you know what? There's still room for improvement under the tiered registry law. That's why I said, please mark this on your calendar, January, February of next year. We're going to be here in Sacramento. We're going to be lobbying the legislators to fix the tiered registry law. And one of the fixes, well, I mentioned a couple of them, Chance. So one of the fixes has to do with felony CP offenses. So people convicted of any felony CP offense right now are assigned to tier three. It's tier one or tier three. There's no tier two assignments, okay? So if it's a misdemeanor CP possession, then you're on tier one. But if you were convicted of felony CP possession, it's tier three. What? You know, this is one of the times when I look at this federal government and the tiers that they put people on under SORNA, and they put CP offenses on tier one and tier two. They don't have any tier three CP offenses. So, and one example here, we're using the federal government as a good example. It's unusual to do that. But the other one, and this was Chance's idea, and we've already lobbied in behalf of it, and not been successful yet, but we're going to go back at it again, aren't we, Chance? And that is for tier three and creating an off-ramp for people assigned to tier three. Would you like to describe that, Chance?
Well, we figured that, you know, the California registry really isn't a true tier registry because it has a lifetime tier. So it's a lifetime registry with two off-ramps. What we would like to do is create a third off-ramp. The issue is after how many years? Well, tier one is 10, tier two is 20. I'd like to see it, you know, less than, but, you know, who knows, between 25 and 30 years. I mean, that's just enough. But there needs to be some kind of off-ramp so that at some point you can say, look, I don't pose a risk anymore, and therefore I shouldn't be monitored anymore. And that would truly then shift the focus, which is what we want to do, from what you're actually convicted of to what the actual risk is. And if we can do that and become a risk-based tiered system, I think it's going to move the whole group, you know, we have over 100,000 registrants. It's going to start to flow on every level. And that really is what is the impetus for all this, is to make our system a true tiered system. So that in a nutshell is what we'd like to do.
Yes. Thank you, Chance. So folks, I think that just about wraps it up for today. I'm again very grateful that you appeared today, and those of you who are listening later, grateful that you're listening as well. We have a lot of material that we presented today. We've answered a lot of questions. We've listened to some really important comments. And two things I want to remind you of. Number one, we have a conference on October 1st. Please sign up for the conference if you haven't already signed up for the conference. And number two, please make a donation. This organization runs by private donations. So far, no one's wanted to give us a grant, even though we apply for them. And that's what I have to say. I hope to see you next month. Chance.
Thank you so much for joining us and being a part of our organization. Thank you.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.